Hi, I'm Dave Barnes.
And I'm John McLaughlin.
And welcome to Dadville.
Dadville is a podcast where we talk about life, love, and the pursuit of awesome dadding.
It's funny thoughts and deep talks.
So please, enjoy your time here in Dadville and enjoy this episode with...
Miles at Cox.
Hey, y'all. It's Dave from Dadville. Hopefully by now you know that Dadville is a wonderful, fun side gig for John and I, as we're both actually singer-songwriters in our real life here in Nashville. And speaking of singer-songwriter, I wanted to tell y'all about my latest release, Remembering Greatest Hits Acoustic. Over the last few months, I've been releasing some of my favorite songs I've ever recorded, and you can hear them all right now. That's literally right now. It has been so fun hearing these stripped down acoustic versions of songs that people know and love. These are the songs that helped me build my career, and I'm so excited to share them with y'all in a new way. So if you can, and you will, and you want to, go check out Remembering Greatest Hits Acoustic, available now. Okay, everybody, John, you're ready.
I'm so ready.
You're ready. Miles is here.
Miles Adcock.
We've got Miles back, everybody. And this is...
God, the hair, man, is on point.
I don't know how you've gotten more handsome.
Dude, here we go.
I'm feeling more
insecure.
This
is a podcast with that hair.
All right.
I've got... What's the joke? A face for radio.
Face for radio, yeah. That is a hair for Netflix.
HFN.
I've got no response. Just a little
you don't need to have. We talk enough for everybody. Okay, so Miles has been on. John and I were talking about this. You were one of the first, probably, like we said, maybe 5 to 10 episodes we did. And not just one of the first ones, but I think we recorded that before we were working with Annie and that.
Yeah, I mean, we had like a year and a half where we were recording episodes. And we just weren't putting them out.
Yeah, there was a good little lag time.
So I think we recorded your episode, and then maybe a year later we put it out, and then that's been 2 years ago.
Yeah, yeah. So we're you could be. Do you still live in Nashville? We don't even know if you're.
Do you still go by Miles?
Well, it was funny. I remember when it recorded, and then a year and a half later, when I got the message, "Hey, your episode's coming out," I had forgotten about that we recorded it, and like, I said,
"Who's
I've changed a lot as a dad in a year?" What did I say?
I don't believe any of this anymore.
Yeah. So for those who haven't caught the first episode, here's a quick refresher, just so you know a little bit more about Miles. We jump in. Chairman and owner of OnSite, an internationally known emotional wellness lifestyle brand that delivers life-changing personal growth workshops, digital mental health masterclasses, emotionally smart leadership retreats, and residential emotional wellness and trauma treatment. Miles' work at OnSite has been featured on 2020, Good Morning America, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Dr. Phil Show, The Doctor's People, Billboard, Dadville. What? That's awesome. We made one.
There we go.
And more. So the quick check-in is, I mean, since we've seen you, which again has been, you know, many a moon, many fortnights, now you have two kids, right?
That's right.
So at the time, I think you barely had one.
Yep. Brand new dad.
Yeah. Yeah. So how is life with two? Like,
what are the ages? Wow.
And if you need to cry or nap, you can.
Both. 3 and 5.
Okay.
Pretty much any question I have to say. How old are my kids?
Yeah.
What are their names? Yeah. I remember the first time I was pretty intimidated. I'm probably not any less intimidated. I always get a little intimidated with great communicators to come on and have a conversation. But now we know each other even better.
Yes.
This feels fun to be back. But the first time I was remembering the podcast is called Dadville. I'm a brand new dad and thinking, what the heck do I have to offer? And I knew I could lean on some of my, you know, training and my profession, but I thought, man, I don't know what the heck I'm doing. And what's interesting is 5 years into it, I'm just as humble today as I was a few months into it. Just learning every day. It is just, what a ride. Exhausted and thrilled and everything in between.
Yeah. Yeah. And the phases, I feel like, change. So my girls are 7 and 9 and yours are 3 and 5. And I'm like, That's such a different experience. 7 and 9 compared to 3 and 5 is so different. Yeah. And like 4 and 6 was different. It's like, it's changing a lot. So you guys have a kindergartner then?
Yeah.
Or almost.
Almost kindergartner. Yeah. Lower school. I'm trying to remember how I told you. I'd be like.
This is literally one of, you need to know that you are in amazing company with dads. Because listen, I feel like most, we do a great job at a lot of things. The on-the-spot question of age or school is pretty much unanimously. Gosh. Everybody takes a... Okay, yeah. No. If they're She, it, she, they're not in the same school. I do know that. We have to go to two different schools. So.
I know they live with us.
I have a, you have a free, your brain like freezes, the panic moments, like I care, but I don't know.
It is one of those things.
Hold on. I care, comma, but I don't know.
But I don't know.
I don't know if there's anything.
That's what I really want the listener to hear. I'm a good father.
I don't know if there's anything.
I don't know my kids or anything about their life, but I love them.
That may be the most emotionally articulate representation of a dad, the plight of a dad that I've ever heard on this podcast.
When I was growing up, my dad would always kind of blank on my birthday or say, like, I don't know, when was your birthday? He would always ask me, and I never knew. My dad has such dry humor. I never knew if he was joking. I suspect it's like half the time he was joking, half the time he's doing the bit because he can't remember, like, when were you born again?
Yeah, tell me when that was.
And I always like, this is a side that we can cut out, but I always, when it comes to names, I freeze up. Like if right now someone walked up to this group and you guys didn't know this person, it's possible that I would blank for a few seconds on all of your names.
Yeah.
It's happened when I was like standing with my sister, who I've known for a long time. And somebody walked up, and there was like 4 solid seconds where I'm like, what's my sister? I'm going to have to introduce them. What is her name? I don't know.
What is her name?
Becky? Megan. It's Megan. Okay. Now, what's their name? Anyway.
Honestly.
That is gold.
I'm so refreshed to hear that because you think you're the only one. That 2 weeks ago that happened to me with a colleague I've worked with for a decade who I was seconds away from introduction and went blank.
Oh,
it's, like, totally it's the pressure.
I don't know her name.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's
you know, for us, lyrics.
Oh, I
bro,
can't
that
imagine.
Is. I can't tell you how much of a struggle that is for me.
But the one talk. Well, not one. I've bombed a few, but the one talk I felt I bombed the worst was, of course, a TEDx talk, one of the biggest ones I had an opportunity to do, and it was the one time I tried to memorize my content.
Oh, ooh. Yeah.
And they told me to. When I went in, they really prep you and they scare you. They say you have to write out every word and you have to memorize these, what the TEDx coaches were telling me at the time. I'm sure it's not that way everywhere.
Yeah.
But I panicked. I got up there and just could not remember it.
Yeah.
And so I can't imagine lyrics. That's got to be.
No, you win there because we can strum or play. Until
it's a different part of your brain. I think when you're playing music, it's like a different part of your brain that's being activated. If I were just talking. That seems way harder.
Because you can't, there's nowhere to go. Like you can't, you're like, and that's why what we found.
There's nothing else. You can't strum a guitar for a second.
Like, or just sort of dance for a minute. And everybody's like, oh, I don't really care what he had to say. Look at these moves. And then you're like, okay, what's the, you're just standing there. It's just, how about the game last night? Okay, where was I? You know, like
what am I doing? Where
am I? Guitar, you can stop. Like we can do the thing where it's like, guys, forgot it, and it's actually kind of endearing because people are like, oh, it's okay. Remember, here's a lyric, and you're like, all right, here we go.
Yeah.
I mean, you're speaking. It's like just dead air.
Oof. Well, and in this case, I have a little bit more of an excuse because they have at TEDx World, time is everything.
Yeah,
and you get a certain allotted amount of time. I think mine was 20 minutes. And you have a confidence monitor that tells you what your next slide's going to be. And you have a timer up front, which is not comforting, but at least you know where you are. Yeah. When I went out there, the confidence monitor went black and the timer went black.
Oh, my gosh, Miles.
Oh. So this is not your fault.
No.
Well, then it was just me and the content, and I just lost it all. I kind of had a panic moment. Yeah. I did the best that I could, and it probably wasn't as bad as I pulled it. So TEDx, because they felt so bad because of what happened with the technical glitch, they said, we'll give you an opportunity to come back and do it again. And I scheduled a year later to do it again. And 2 days before my TEDx talk, Maverick was born. And so I watched it and went into never turned back on it.
Nice.
But it is interesting because my wife grew up acting and she's done that her whole life and she's really good at it.
Yeah, yeah.
In every other area of her life, she would claim to be like what we're talking about where she can be forgetful and a little spacey. Mm-hmm. But she's got a method and she knows how to memorize lines and she can do it. And it's really I think I've even heard from actor friends that it's harder in this season than ever before. And my theory is that most of us, I think, are probably suffering suffering from consumption fatigue.
Yeah, yeah.
Because we've
yeah.
just got millions yeah. of data points yeah. coming into our yeah. minds. So there's just no margin to yeah. hold yeah. stuff like we maybe used to.
Yeah, true. Yeah.
Okay, before we get rolling, I want to tell a little story that I actually told you. We bumped into each other at a restaurant a couple months ago, but I want the listeners to know. So a few months ago, I was in Atlanta with the family. We were visiting some friends, and a friend of a friend was at this lunch, and we're introducing everybody, we're meeting everybody, and he says, hey, and I really love your podcast. It changed my life.
Wow.
And it was like a light moment, you know, like it was like this really heavy sort of like, wait, did he just say it changed his life? I didn't know if he was joking or if he was being hyperbolic or whatever.
Was it your dad?
I wanted it to be
hard to read if he was joking.
and so I was like, oh, thanks. You know, he's like, I want to talk to you about it later, but you know, didn't want to do it in front of the group. So later on, he kind of pulls me aside and he's like, I was listening to Dadville and listening to the Miles Adcox episode. And it literally, like what he said, and it really affected me, really impacted me. At the end of the episode, I like called on-site, went to on-site, changed my life. And the house where we were at was this guy's best friend. And his friend later on told me like it 100%, like he, wow. his life is in a completely different trajectory. That episode changed his life.
Wow.
So really, incredible? We're kind of the Scottie Pippen to the Michael Jordan of on-site.
That's right.
Like, we didn't really change his life.
He passed the ball. Hey,
you know what? It was time well spent because I have had, and I'm Ashley will tell you, my colleague who's with me here, I'm trying not to do a lot of external activity because I'm really trying to finish a book. But there's some conversations I just want to say yes to. This is one of them because it had shelf life. It carried. I've had a lot of people that listen. And I remember starting and leaving the conversation feeling inadequate about where we were going because in a sense, I felt, well, this is the on-site guy. He's probably got some expertise around parenting and the way to do it.
In these 2 weeks.
And I remember saying on the front end, I was like, guys, I am in full learning mode. Mm. I don't know if I've got anything to offer here. But I think all three of us were. And there was something, I need to go back and listen to it to see if we had anything of value. But apparently,
I could tell we did.
A lot of people connected to, I guess, just the authenticity of three dads circling up with some wisdom and experience, but also a lot of humility that, man, this, I don't think you can be an expert at this.
Totally. Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. Totally. So one of the things, you know, like John was saying that we thought would be so great to have you on is just to talk more about that specifically, just kind of therapy on-site, what you guys are doing there, because something we haven't, you know, we've done on the podcast before and sort of like we've, you know, alighted just to sort of fly off again quickly. You know, it's not been a podcast really dedicated to just kind of therapy and what that means. And so obviously thinking about you is like, one, that story was so great. And it's such a great lead in to that is just the power of what you guys are doing with on-site. But can you talk more about on-site and just for those who are listening, like what that is, what y'all do, you know, what you're hoping to achieve kind of there and how you'll help people?
Yeah. So obviously on-site's where I spend the majority of my time. It's an emotional wellness retreat space. We got a couple locations now, but we also do a lot of stuff digitally. But more than that, I'd say that the mission is to create an emotionally well world and kind of reconnect humanity in a way. And I know that's a big, lofty goal. But I, from someone who found myself in need of the services we provide in my early 20s, it kind of knocked me off my feet as somebody who didn't know what was going on, but knew something wasn't going right and didn't really know where to go to access the right, to find the right support. And it was a bumpy entry into the space. And then when I found the right support, I went on this really deep journey, you know, a few years of excavating and deconstructing my story and then rebuilding it with the right people around me. And it just was an amazing harvest towards the back end. I felt better about who I was. I felt clear about who I was becoming. And for whatever reason, I didn't look at it once I had the experience as punitive, like I was fixing a broken part of myself. But I looked at the way therapy and counseling has been branded and continues to be branded for years as all wrong. It is set up to the general public is this is where you go when something's wrong with you. Mm. Mm-hmm. And I got passionate and determined after I had my own experience to try to figure out how we could shift the paradigm of the way we frame change or growth or transformation or healing from you're fixing the broken parts of you to you're reclaiming the best parts of you in a sense.
That's a great way to put it.
Turn it from this shame-based, stigma-based process to just becoming a better human being. Mm. And I've on-site really for me is more human school than anything. And maybe the thing I'm most proud about it, and I stand on the shoulders of some giants that represent us as our team. So I get way too much credit just because of my role and my title, when really the credit goes to my team. They're the ones that are really good at what they do, know what they do. But our big initiative is not to provide the best counseling out there, even though I think we provide great counseling, great expertise. It's more to shift the stigma about how we're communicating and bringing the concept of change to the world. Mm-hmm. And I want it to feel more like human school than the hiding anonymously in the basement of a church in order to share your deepest, darkest secrets. I would love to put myself and Onsite out of business one day so that, you know, a legacy could be that we're having conversations that we have in counseling. I don't mean to demean our profession because it does require a high level of training and expertise. And there'll be certain parts for it that will always be relevant and needed. But if the basic premise could be psychologically safe, vulnerable conversations that could happen in the classroom, the boardroom, our living rooms, then I think that would be a game changer. I think we'd move a little closer toward our goal of reconnecting humanity. Now, I realize you asked me about Onsite, and I quickly jumped on a soapbox, so I probably confused people, but we offer a lot of therapeutic personal growth, self-development experiences in short-term intensive workshop formats. And we just try to put really good, you know, content out there that brings meaning and value back into the human experience. Mm.
And you guys do, you specialize in like group therapy, right? Is it all group therapy?
It's not. We do individual intensives as well, couples intensives, family intensives, but we do put a high focus on groups.
Hey, John.
Don. I went with Don.
What?
It's just the two of our names. We don't have time.
I thought that Dawn. I didn't know if there was somebody I needed to be worried about.
No.
Somebody's coming to stake my claim here, John. I'm going to get defensive. I'll throw some bows and you know that. Listen, are you ready to tell our listeners about some of our incredible friends who are changing lives right down the street as well as around the world?
Let's do it, Dave. Two words. Everybody, Thistle Farms.
Yeah. Thistle like the purple thorny weed?
Yeah, like the purple weed, Dave.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Now, hang on, Dave. Before you get your thinking cap in a tangle, right, let me tell you the why behind it.
All right.
Thistle Farms provides healing, housing, and employment for women survivors of trafficking, prostitution, and addiction. Thistles, although considered weeds, are resilient. They are tough, like the women survivors whom Thistle Farms serves.
Listen, John, we are songwriters, and we love a good metaphor.
Yeah, we
and
do.
A good mission. Thistle Farms has it all.
That's right. You know what else they have, Dave?
Tell me.
A pretty darn good shave gel.
You look amazing this morning.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I mean, what's better than lathering up in hope and healing, Dave?
I don't know.
The way that Thistle Farms provides women survivors 2 years of free housing, trauma therapy, medical assistance, and job training. They fund their program by selling products that their program participants make. Mm. And let me tell you, Dave, they have a lot more than shave gel.
Wow.
Candles, gift sets, leather bags and wallets, home decor, and so much more.
Wow. Okay, well, I'm going to head over to their website, and all of our listeners should too, so they can learn more about Thistle Farms and get themselves a candle, shave gel, a leather wallet, and so much more, all made by a survivor. And if our listeners enter the code DADVILLE at checkout, they'll receive 15% off their purchase at thistlefarms.org. So, what are you waiting for?
Which, that's not something, you know, I go to therapy one-on-one, me and my therapist, but talk about the group therapy and some of the dynamics. I've heard some really amazing stories about, you know, some of the exercises, for lack of a better word, maybe, that you guys do, and some of the like really powerful things that have come about while doing some of these like you know, almost role playing kind of things. You know, like what are some of the things about group therapy that are so powerful.
And I should have clarified when I said we do individual intensives, the difference in us and what you might experience in private practice with your traditional 1 hour session is when I say intensives, we do like 3 and 4 day, 6, 8 hour a day.
This is like a destination people are going
That's
to.
That's right. Yeah, or we come to people too, but I'm thankful we got to be part years ago of kind of innovating that intensive model in that the 50 minute session has its place, I think. And it's necessary and it's proven to be impactful, but it's really hard to come from a really busy life, drop in for an hour, and then get kind of slingshotted back out into the rapid pace of life. So when you can unplug and distance yourself, there's a huge advantage. Mm-hmm. The second best advantage I think we have is we try to use an experiential model of change. It's not all we use because experiential therapy and everything that falls underneath that umbrella is an expertise we hang our hat on. A lot of times people think that's all we do, and it's not. We use any modality of change that's relevant, that's researched, and that's effective and important. But experiential is where what we love. And I love it because it's what finally got to me. Mm. It's what broke through to me. We talked in the beginning of our conversation about how difficult it can be to keep track of life. And I don't know if that is because I'm diagnosed ADD. I've had it for a long time. I had the H early on, but I dropped the H somewhere. I gave it to Dave.
I was going to say, I think I picked that
Dave
up.
Dave has two H's.
Yeah. Still highly distracted, but not very hyper. But anyway, where was I going with that? Experiential. So sitting and talking and cognitively processing my story, I wasn't having a lot of breakthroughs or progress with that. I really liked it. It was interesting. I found it valuable. But that traditional counseling approach, I needed something a little more interactive and experiential to hold my attention and to engage me in a focused way. Mm-hmm. And really all experiential is an umbrella of different modalities that would try to take someone's story and make it more visible, three-dimensional, make it come alive through art, music, role play, drama. There's a lot of different ways to do it. We use animal-assisted therapy, equine therapy, but it's bringing something else into the story so that you can see it versus just hear it.
Yeah.
Because we do know that if I were to say something to you, it kind of activates a third of your brain. If I show it to you, it activates two-thirds. And if we make it kinesthetic and put action around it, it activates all of it. So that's what experiential does. And it's when you're in a group, it can be really... Usually when we're in a self-reflective process, anybody who's got a little shame in their story, which it's hard as a human not to have some of that, it's hard not to take the... Once you get the tools to self-assess, it's hard to get the microscope off yourself. Because all you're doing is just shining a big light on your challenges, your areas of improvement, or your historic adversity. And when you get other people in the room who can be a mirror of feedback... And can say, I just saw you or just experienced you do that piece of work, or I played a role for you doing that piece of work. And first of all, you need to hear, here's how I related to it. Boom. Our brain automatically assimilates to, oh my goodness, I'm not alone in this. Yeah. So you kind of, the microscope comes down on yourself and a mirror comes up of empathy towards you and other people. And it's really, an irreplaceable process. I wish I could get everybody through a group therapy process because I'm so passionate about it. Mm-hmm. Some people's story and their professions require an individual private process. But I would say if our goal was to have someone walk out of an experience having more empathy for themselves and other people, it's really hard not to have that in a group experience if it's facilitated well.
Yeah. So Miles and I are in a men's group with a bunch of other guys here in Nashville, and I haven't been on site because when I applied, they just responded ha ha ha, and that was it, which is weird. but I haven't been able to go out there. But we've done some of these exercises, and it was just so. First of all, it's terrifying. Like anybody listening that's going like that sounds like it is terrifying. There's no way around the fact that you immediately feel like what is happening right now. You know, just because it's such a new experience and. You're very much sort of doing these things that just aren't native to how we work, you know, which is why it's so powerful, obviously. But it was so cool seeing in those moments, as you know, as it goes, you sort of, you know, in a wonderful way, you really do get involved and you sort of forget yourself in these, you know, but watching the power of what I learned watching other people, I mean, I remember, I think the hardest I've cried maybe in my life, I wasn't even, like, it was somebody telling his story and we were, and I just couldn't keep it together because so, I just felt like I was, it was that thing where I was like, oh my gosh, this is what I'm doing. This is exactly what I'm doing. And it wasn't even me doing it, you know? And so I think it, seeing it done is such a powerful, I didn't know that. I mean, and I haven't even been through the intensives, but even those times that we've done it in our men's group and just watching these guys and seeing, you know, I remember one specifically where this guy had this revelation that as a 30-something year old man, he had never put these two things together, but doing one of these role plays, he just lost it. He said out loud to us, like, I have never been able to, and so you realize as someone who's been in traditional therapy for such a long time, which has been so helpful, it's like you said, it's just such a different thing. It's just a, you know, it's such a different take. And then, you know, I know I have friends who've done the, you know, the horse therapy, which at first you're like, okay, like how much peyote is happening out there? And is it, you know, what shaman sort of delivers
the pictured someone in a white robe riding up on a white horse.
Don't touch the horse. Don't touch the horse. He will look at you in the eye and tell you what's wrong. But, you know, even hearing, like, I had a friend walk me through what that was like and how it was just crazy. Like, it's things and what he learned from it and how profound these moments were of finding, you know, even with that. So it's such a different, you know, for anybody that's listening, that's even considering it, it's such a different, it's not the thing you think that it is, you know, it's not something where you're going to go and sit, which again, it's so helpful, but it really is such an experiential thing. And I don't know anybody that's ever been, that doesn't come back, that just is like, holy cow. And what, you know, which I've heard, I feel like I've heard you describe it this way, but it's like a, you know, it's kind of a supercharged, it's like, you know, drinking from a fire hydrant where you think about how many times one-on-one it takes to kind of get to things. Those weekends or those 3 or 4 day intensives tend to be like consolidating almost like a year's worth of work into sort of these 3 or 4 days, you know, so you can leave feeling much more sort of like, wow, okay, these were, one, I never would, like, I'm never going to, like, I try to think that I'm a pretty, like, emotionally connected guy, but every time we start one of those things, I'm always like, oh my gosh, here we go. Here we go.
We're leaning in.
There's no, and so, but it's such a beautiful thing. And I think, like you said, it's, I'm curious with you. I mean, is it hard? I think about this when I think about you doing that and my friends who are in that space. Is it hard to leave that there when you leave? Is it hard not taking that stuff home?
It can be. And just to reflect on you made a really valid point that I wanted to shine a light on when you talked about, really you were talking about being in an auxiliary role instead of the protagonist.
Right.
If you think about it in terms of story. And that's the beauty of experiential therapy. I mean, we get wounded, we get stressed, we experience adversity through the lens of life experience. And I think our jobs as creative professionals in the change space, i.e. therapists and counselors, should curate experiences for people to heal in. Mm-hmm. And if we get wounded in experience, we also heal in experience. So you have to curate a really good experience. But often people think, well, I'm here to do my work, which is mean you'd look at your story and you'd be the protagonist of a particular scene. But if you ask 95% of the people a year out, 2 years out, 3 years out, what did you work on while you were at on-site? You usually don't remember. You don't remember. Crazy. What you do remember is what you witnessed in other people's stories. So the auxiliary role is incredibly powerful because I think it takes down our natural defenses. And we suddenly relax because the spotlight's not on us, but you suddenly see right through someone's story and you see yourself. Mm-hmm. It happens to me a lot when I go. It's why I love movie theaters. And I'm so sad when they got shut down. And, of course, the violence that happened in them, they became not so attractive. But I've been following the Nicole Kidman AMC train and trying to go to movie theaters again. But I went and saw Maverick, Top Gun. This past weekend with a buddy, and I got to be in the auxiliary role for 2 hours. I got to turn my brain off, not think, and be in the midst of a really great story. And I had an experience. Like I saw myself so much in his character, and then the young Goose's son's character, especially when, you know, the, trust your instincts. Don't think, just do. All those little things. I was like, oh my gosh, I was ready to come out of the chair. Well, that's kind of what we try to do at OnSite, is curate people's stories, except for their true real life stories, so that you can witness and benefit as a part of the process. And you're right. Most of us aren't wired and culturally conditioned to lean in that kind of way. Our job also, and maybe the most important job we have at OnSite, is to curate a psychologically safe and ecosystem and environment for people to do that in. And it's about 24 hours in an intensive experience where usually people settle in and they go mm-hmm. from thinking this is terrifying to thinking this is the safest place I've ever been.
Wow.
And I think you might be able to relate to that in our group. Mm-hmm. It's usually you've got that right at, like you're standing on the edge of the Grand Canyon, you know, looking off, and psychological safety would be the opposite of, imagine walking to the edge of the Grand Canyon and somebody has their hand in the middle of your back. Mm-hmm. You know, how close are you actually going to get to vulnerability? Not very. That's the way we used to do it. We try to push and motivate people into change with confrontation. Not sustainable. What we've learned is that if we can join people instead of push or pull them, then they're much more likely to walk up to the edge of what we know is actually true safety, just on the other side of our fear. I went on a rabbit trail, and I'll circle back just to say that's probably the question you ask, just to remind those that are listening about, is it hard not to take it home? For me, that I think that's the hardest part.
Really?
Yep. And there's a lot of methods that you can put into debriefing, staffing, offloading some of what we consume when we hear people's stories, just to try to prevent the vicarious and secondary nature of trauma, you know, when you take on so many. But I'm very human, and I'm sensitive, and that's what makes me good at my job. I am good in crisis, and yet I also can consume a lot of what I hear. I can get really passionate about it. Last night I was with a buddy who's a very prolific songwriter, and he's accomplished everything he's accomplished. He's had a 4-decade career, and I said, "Have you gotten tired of it? And are you still having fun? Have you gotten tired of it?" And he said, "I still love it every day." And he said, "How about you?" And I said, "I still love it, but I definitely get tired of it." And I think the part of me that gets tired and a little burned out sometimes is the consumption of adversity all the time.
Yeah.
Now we try to get super creative in our culture to come up with a lot of different ways, especially for our frontline clinicians, to offload the stories they consume throughout the day and throughout the week. But it's still a human experience. I've not met many people, especially in the pandemic, our attrition and our turnover was as high as I've ever seen it. People were just tired. So it comes with the territory. If you're not honest about it and aware that if you think you're superhuman and you're not impacted, that's when I think it really gets dangerous. So I try to be honest to say, I don't have that perfected. I don't do it well all the time. What has helped a ton is that historically, when I was like younger and newer in the field, this has come with some seasoning and experiences. I could go weeks or months or even years and not acknowledge it. Just powered through an overdrive. I'm passionate. My identity's in this. This is what I do. This is what God made me to be. I'm supposed to be the guy that takes everybody's story and helps them. And that was just a setup for burnout. And it happened to me a handful of times in my careers where I just crashed. And I'm lucky I made it. You know, I made it because I love what I do. Now the time between when it happens and when I recognize it has gotten way shorter. So now I know what to do when it happens, that I need to talk about it, that I need to pull back and take a break. Don't always listen to it like I should right away, but at least I've got the awareness to know it's
like
on board.
You can tell when it's iterating, and like you can tell, I've got either physically or like you have signs now to go like, oh, I know what that means. Okay. That's fascinating.
And there was a season in my life where I didn't know what I didn't know. I was having a very human experience to working in the helping profession. Probably on the edge of burnout more times than not, and I didn't even know it because I was just powering through.
Yeah.
So when I hear that the whole hustle culture, and don't get me wrong, I'm a driven entrepreneur. I love to chase my dreams. I love to work hard. I encourage people to do it. Love work ethic. But I think if we don't acknowledge that, if we pull the soul out of being a professional in whatever our field is, then it's a recipe for a crash at some point.
Dave. Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hey, do you hear that?
Hold on. Oh, Yes, actually. Well, assuming you're talking about the Iron Maiden blaring from the neighbor's house.
Yeah.
Yeah, I do hear
yeah,
that.
Okay. Yeah, okay. I thought it was just me. Anyway, can I tell you about this amazing cookware that I just got for Amy?
Sean, how long have we been friends? Okay? On one condition.
Yeah.
As you're doing it, you need to make at least 3 Beatles references.
Okay.
Can you do that?
Challenge accepted. Let me tell you about Caraway, Dave.
Okay.
Caraway cookware.
Okay.
You see, Caraway Homes non-toxic kitchenwares are all designed for the modern home and feature a chemical-free ceramic coating, Dave, so food can be prepared with peace of mind that no hard-to-pronounce compound will leach into your healthy ingredients. Gross.
Nice. I bet Annie would be into this, too.
Well, she would.
You don't think they listen to the pod, do you? I just don't want to spoil surprise.
I guarantee you.
Okay, good.
Yeah, no chance.
Okay. I can see there's a cookware and a bakeware set. That's right.
In my life, I've been a cookware guy.
Oh, yeah. I see what you did there. Okay, taking the challenge up.
The cookware set takes a traditional 16-piece set boiled down to 4 essentials, Dave.
Okay,
a fry pan.
1.
Okay. A saute pan.
2.
A saucepan.
3.
And, of course, a Dutch oven.
4. Sounds like there's something about it. Hey, I'm playing two.
Here we go. All right, get this. The naturally slick ceramic surface means minimal oil or butter for slide-off-the-pan eggs and easy cleaning. That alone will make a hard day's night much easier.
Look at this. One more to go. Okay, listen. You've convinced me, Johnny.
Okay.
But what happens now?
All right. Well, lastly, let me tell you how I've been using my Caraway cookware set.
Gosh.
I've made a glass onion, a honey pot, and an amazing Savoy truffle.
You did it, and it's not that I didn't think you could, but there were people out there.
They were saying I couldn't, and I did.
Murmurs.
And now let me say to them, just visit carawayhome.com/dadville to take advantage of this limited time offer for 10% off your next purchase.
This deal is exclusive for our listeners, not just any of those Lucy in the skies with their diamonds, okay, guys?
Oh, my goodness,
Visit carawayhome.com/dadville or use code DADVILLE at checkout. Caraway, non-toxic cookware made modern.
Hate you.
Oh, that's 5. So this is a great, this sort of leads me into the next question I want to ask you, which is, you know, and I think we would all agree it'd be great if everybody could get some sort of therapy, no matter what your story is, just, you know, just to sort of check in and see how you're doing and maybe exhume some things from even decades ago that you sort of don't know.
Well, one of the things that you said, I think in our first conversation that is one of the things I always have top of mind from all these episodes that we've done in Dadville, is you said, I think we were asking, like, you know, how do you feel about therapy for everyone? Like, who should go to, how do you know when you should go? And you said everyone deserves to go to therapy.
Yeah, that's a great way.
Which I thought was such a great way to frame it.
So how do you, for people that are listening, that maybe that's a new thought, like you know, they haven't ever done therapy, or you know, they listen to what you're saying, they're like, that's not even in my view of life, you know. When would you say to people listening, it may be this would be something to watch and maybe is a good reason to go now? Like, when is a good time to consider that? Like, what would be the things that, or have you seen in your clients that you go, that's kind of a tell for it's probably time to sit down with somebody? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think,
other than just being a human.
Well, yeah. You know, I think we're headed that way to where you don't need a catalyst
to pursue
the best version of you.
Right.
If you, but right now it appears that most people need some type of catalyst. Something needs to happen in their life to encourage them to go. Not always, because our demographic is really shifting at OnSite to where we're seeing more people come when life's going really great. And they just want to take 4 days, do a digital detox, raise their emotional intelligence, start to integrate it, become a little emotionally smarter in their relationships, or they're trying to go through a change. So I would say transitions are usually a big one.
Oh,
any kind of transition is a good time. And I don't say it because I think people need it in transitions. I think it's just it's a great opportunity, because I know when people are in transitions, we are twice as likely to be able to support them with change because they're not fixed in a position.
Right. Wow.
We don't have to bypass certain
fences. That's fascinating.
It's interesting how I feel like that's like a theme. Like, that's like a macro kind of transition. And the micro is like all these little things that you guys do. Like, I'm going to have you actually play a role. Like in this exercise, you're going to be this person's mom, or you're going to be, you know, it's like, and I think when people get to on-site, they don't say their occupation. They say like first name and that's it, which that right there in our culture is such a, that's a transition, if you will. Like that, I always say my occupation or something like that. Like that's such a part of our identity that right there is like new footing. It seems like that is the common theme where like novelty and just getting someone out of their fixed routine activates or opens them up, I suppose, to then they can really like actually do some work on themselves from a different vantage point than they always occupy, you know.
It's a great point, and sometimes I think what we facilitate gets more credit than the environment that we support people to come into. Mm-hmm. Meaning, often people think, well, these are the experts. They must know things that would help us change. Mm. And don't get me wrong, we do have some great tools and support, but if you can create the right environment, people have the tools they need to change within them. And one of those is limit distractions. Mm-hmm. And sometimes our professions can be our biggest distraction.
Yeah. Yeah.
When we get so wrapped up in what we do that we forget who we are,
yeah,
it can be difficult. Usually the first 90% of, or yeah, or 90% of the time of new acquaintances or interactions, within the first 30 seconds, we're going to identify what the other person does and what we do.
Hmm. Right.
Did I say that right? Yeah, 90% of the time. And so that leaves 10% that you might actually get to know someone beyond how your brain is sizing them up based on. Mm-hmm. And why do we do that? Usually, we want to know someone's career because we are beyond our thinky-feely brains. We're just survival. We're in survival mode. So we want to know, based on what you do, are you a threat to me? Yeah. Are you an asset to me? You know, how can you? And it's so refreshing when you get to know 50, 60 people in a week and have no idea what anybody does. And suddenly it's like, I actually know a community of human beings instead of human doings, maybe for the first time in my life.
Louise. That's amazing. Remember when I told you that the first time? The another kind of companion question to that one is, you know, trauma. I feel like is much more talked about, and I think a little better understood globally now. It's a word that you hear a lot more in this space, and again, for sort of part two of, I guess, that first question is, how, you know, anyone that's listening to this that may think they may have some of that, which I think we all do. Whether it's big T or little T, or if it's all just all caps, whatever, you know, trauma. Someone listening to this, it's like, I wonder if I do, what are the things you would say, here's how we see it iterate that you need to, that would, like, you know, it's like when you're, what is that? When they find oil, like they know that on the top, this is where oil is below because we know what it looks like on the top, you know, and if we drill, mm-hmm. there's going to be oil. What is the version of that with trauma? Like, what are things that somebody listening, you go, you may want to sit with somebody because this is how trauma iterates if you're feeling that iteration in your life. Does that make sense?
Sure. Yeah, trauma is something we obviously specialize in. And I'm excited now that culture has kind of accepted it as a term. It feels like it's heading that way. So it's not mm-hmm. near as much stigma. In 15, 20 years ago, it felt like pushing a snowball up a hill to get people to listen. And now trauma has become pop culturized, and there's a really good side of that, mm-hmm. and there's a bit of a dangerous side to that. Same thing happened to codependency back mm-hmm. in the 80s mm-hmm. when people were talking about that. All the codependency never made it into the DSM for the Diagnostic Statistical Manual mm-hmm. that they use. PTSD did. Mm-hmm. When codependency got pop culturized, it kind of lost its meaning a little bit because mm-hmm. it's like everybody's got it. If you open a door for somebody, you're codependent. And then everybody's like, well, am I codependent? Yeah, the world's codependent. What does it mean? But codependency can be a debilitating, suffering condition that a lot of people, you know, deal with. Trauma, I think, is the same way. And, you know, Bessel van der Kolk has defined trauma as anything other than nurturing.
Wow.
Which really levels the playing field. And I actually love that definition because who hasn't experienced that somewhere along the timeline? But I think we got to be careful with the difference between trauma, psychological trauma, and a diagnosis of post-traumatic stress disorder, because that can be a really serious, you know, condition that we don't want to water down. But I lean more on the side of exactly what you described, which is I think trauma is a human condition. And I don't think people escape it. And if trauma is an activating word, then just plug in adversity and stress. Nobody escapes adversity. Adversity generates stress, especially in our culture. We don't have natural outlets built in for stress-reducing experiences. So therefore, stress compounds in our system and creates trauma. And so if you find yourself experiencing a lot of stress and you have anxiety, if you're losing sleep, if you've got changes in your appetite, either eating too much or not enough, if you're finding yourself really are struggling to be present, if you're, ironically, like we talked about in the beginning, if you're forgetting a lot of things, usually that's our brain and our body trying to tell us something. And it could mean that there is more significant things happening below the surface and be a great invitation or good time to talk to somebody.
Man, that's a great word. Good night.
I want to get back to kind of, Dave, your earlier question where you were talking about how is it hard to not bring this home and have it affect you, you know, when you're quote unquote off the clock. Do you have like a couple sort of habits that you have put in place that, you know, are really effective in helping you sort of like offload that or get you know, not bring work home?
Yeah, there's something we do in counseling circles that we need a better name for it. It's called clinical staffing, where we circle up a couple times a day and we ask each other a series of questions about what came up for you. What'd you notice? You'd think we'd be getting together to talk about our caseload or the clients that we're supporting, and that does come. But first, at least the way we do it, is we focus on, did you have any transference? Did you have any countertransference? Did anything activate you during the talk? And simply, now, I'm not frontline. I'm not seeing people in that way. That's what our teams do. But I still am on the phone all day, every day, downloading people's stories. So for me, it's just finding a safe presence to tell someone else about it. Just communicating it helps a ton. Taking it from I'm sitting on that to now I've shared that with another person. And if I don't have another person to do it with, often it's just writing it down. And then I've learned there are stress reducing experiences outside of work that fill me up when I'm feeling a bit depleted. One of those is horses. One of those is music. There's things that I love to do that if I can engage in those and amp up the time that I give those when I'm in a season of consuming a lot, it helps balance it out a little bit.
That's great.
Yeah.
Which takes a lot of, you sort of got to know yourself to know those things, you know, like, no, oh yeah. Like, because somebody you know will be like, oh, for me, it's running. And then you try running, you're like, this is not doing the thing. So it takes a little trying and going, oh, okay, that's it. That's one of those things for me.
There's one more, maybe a simple one. It may seem silly, but it's actually worked pretty good for me. As I had heard this come from, I can't remember if it was out of China or Japan. It was definitely an Asian culture. But I had heard or read a story one time, and I started doing it where when I come home, before I come through the front door to engage with the family and the kids and dinner and whatever's going on, I will go straight to my room, in my closet, change clothes, get out of the clothes from the day, and put on home clothes, and then walk out and hug my family and say hello. And there's something about the idea
Rogers.
Of taking off work and then putting on home.
That is
fascinating. I love that. I love things like that are like a tangible practice that has a psychological effect, whether we even, you know, buy it or not, just do it. I'm sure it would just have an effect on you.
Ways to trigger your brain. Like with physical
again,
things.
It's like that same kind of concept of like, do these things and your brain will, it will just subtly change. It's like you're tricking your brain a little bit, you know? That's so fascinating.
That's great.
But I was going to say earlier, like it's you have to know yourself, like you're saying, like to know, you know, what is going to work for you, what habits are going to actually be stress relieving. And I feel like in my 30s, I have really come to know myself on like the other side of that coin, which is like there's so many habits that I or tendencies that I do that are tells of stress and anxiety and all that kind of stuff that I for so long I didn't realize. And, you know, Amy, my wife, is very helpful in this, where she's like, you know, hey, are you okay? Because you're cleaning the counter. And, you know, and I'm like, I don't even realize. Like, that's one of my things. Like, I'm cleaning before I even realize if I'm stressed, you know.
Cleaning a clean counter.
Yeah, exactly. Just like I'm rubbing
the
marble. That
was the name of his autobiography.
Yeah, yeah.
One of the things I wanted to ask you a couple of questions, because these are things that I think, like when I look at sort of where we are in the world and where therapy is in the world and sort of like the place that it's taken, as you were kind of talking about trauma doing that too. One of the things that I've noticed is there is a little bit of a perceived disconnect from older generations with therapy and then like our generation, especially the younger generations, like how each of them take to it, how much more of a popular idea it is to our generation younger, like it's much more talked about or accepted or seen as okay. And then older generations, like, you know, my parents' generation, the generation kind of between us and even older, especially, it's a little bit more of like a, you know, it's a taboo thing sometimes, like this idea that like you need to go get help and you don't know what you're doing. One, why do you think that that is? Like, why do you think that those, and I think every generation struggles with it. That's not at all what I'm trying to say. But I do think there's, you know, it's just seen very differently. Like, I think, one, why do you think that is such a different thing for those older generations? And then two, how do you find yourself, like, engage with that ideology, you know, around therapy? Like, how do you engage those kind of generations when trying to represent and you know, argue there's a place for it and it's important, like, you know?
Yeah, it's a great question. I had a really good challenge and opportunity as early as yesterday to speak to the generation, our parents' generation.
Yeah.
You know, successful executives, that was a business group, that were in the late stages of their career looking at their succession plans, and they asked a mental health guy to come talk. And I'm like, you know, I knew at least culturally the stigma around what this group. So I went in thinking,
I mean, that's kind of the tip of the spear, in my opinion, not just that generation, but successful, high functioning people. Like that would be, that to me would be really intimidating.
So I was even sharing with Ashley, I was nervous going in. I was like, I don't know how to, you know, I got to figure out how to break through to these guys. And I really went into it, and I found this to be effective, trying to think about how do I take what I know and what I believe in based on what I've learned with my training and my own pursuit of emotional health and just having a more integrative life, and strip back the language in a way so that I can bridge without activating.
Yes. And yes.
And it's hard to do because I live in the world of talking about psychology through the lens of people's pathology. Mm-hmm. But if you use words like trauma, anxiety, depression, even if you get into the healing side of it and you start talking about healing modalities, like we were talking about earlier, some people, we've lost them, you know, get into that. That's why I usually don't reveal a ton before people come, because they're like, I'm not going to that place. It sounds crazy. And they don't know when you get there. We make it really realistic. But with these guys, it's how do you neutralize the language in a way that you're speaking a language they can understand versus trying to make them understand a language that I live in.
Right.
That's my struggle too with the, you know, the faith communities, and it can be really hard to do, but if you see somebody that knows how to do it, it's amazing that where they can communicate the principle behind the message without using the language to deliver
message. That's right.
And I try to do that in therapy and psychology as well with that audience. Why do I think that it's different now than it was with the generations before us? It's a big question, but overall, I think we just didn't know what we didn't know. Hmm. And I think it's another example of how humanity evolves. We learn a little bit more about the brain, and we know a lot about the brain now, but we still don't know a lot about the brain. We're probably, in terms of understanding the neurology of change and pain for that matter, we're probably where computer science was in the 80s, where it's like we're on a rocket, but we still don't know a lot. But we know more than we did know. So we're not laying in tanning beds anymore, ideally.
Right.
not smoking cigarettes. We're wearing seat belts. And we're realizing that therapy is a useful and important thing that any of us could benefit from on any point in our lives.
Mm. Yeah.
That's amazing.
I feel like the semantics like the words are really fascinating, because I feel like in the little bit of time that I have been going to therapy, and Amy and I both realize like the words really matter.
Yes.
Like the way that I mean, you know, sort of like marriage counseling 101 or conflict counseling is like, you don't say like you always, et cetera, et cetera. You know, like there's some basic forms of communication that are really, really helpful, that it doesn't change your, you know, hurt. It doesn't change what this person did to you, but the way that you present your case or whatever, the words that you use are really important. And the challenge in this with the different generations, or just people who maybe hear that word trauma or the phrase little t trauma or whatever, immediately their eyes are rolling and they're, you know, that it's difficult. That's a challenge to try to communicate these truths to people who you don't know what the, you know, what terminology is going to trigger them. Whatever,
even the word emotional can be loaded for some people.
Yeah. Like
yesterday, I was trying to talk about leadership, and depending on the audience, you know, we talk about emotionally smart leadership and emotional intelligence and leadership a lot. But I was thinking, this group, how am I going to say something? And so instead of saying emotionally smart leadership or showing the benefits of emotional intelligence, it was, you know, the theory I want to talk to you guys about is that we become better leaders by becoming better human beings.
Yeah.
And where do you learn to be a better human? There's plenty of places to go learn how to be a better manager and a better leader, but
wow,
who talks about the human behind the leadership? Mm-hmm. And then I moved them in. I wrote an acronym yesterday morning and tried it out on Ashley, who's with us today. And I was like, should I try this? And it was soul. And I thought, so really what I want to do is put the soul back into being human. We've taken the soul out of leadership and out of being human. And soul, the acronym I use is self, others, us, leadership. And it was really, leadership is the last of the of the platform. I can't really lead until I do some work on me and understand me, self. I can't really influence others until I understand and better empathize with others. Mm. Others. If I know me and I know and understand others, then I can understand how others and me interact with one another, us. And so I didn't say all the little part in between I'm filling in now, but I just said, think about self, others, us. And if we can get those three things right, we can do leadership in life really well.
God, that's great. So that leads to the second question, because these were the two things I think so much about this space. So one is like how there's some dissonance with older generations and trying to have those conversations. I think especially with people who have done therapy and you're trying to kind of explain it to your parents or trying to sort of like engage in that, it can get tricky because they're kind of like, ooh, these are scary words to me. Or, you know, it can just be tricky, which you spoke to.
Well, with parents, for example, it can feel threatening.
Yes.
Because they're like,
very well said.
Especially, what did I do wrong?
Yeah. Why do you need therapy? Which is always a really fun conversation after that. second question I had, and you just spoke to this, is, you know, therapy is also tricky because it can so quickly turn into a self-focused cycle. Like, and I know you guys on the front line see that so much, where you can, someone does it and then all of a sudden it becomes a little bit of like, we can turn into me monsters, all of us can, right? Yep. And so what do you think are, and I think this is, you speak about the church and sort of Christendom, I think this may be one of the biggest problems with therapy and how that space sees therapy is kind of like, you know, well, it just turns these people into like everything is self. I'm working on me and I'm doing my work and I'm doing, you know, which are great things. And to your point, like you think about that's where we do need to start. But, you know, how do you, like, what are healthy disciplines? One is a question I was going to ask around doing self work so it doesn't. And then when do you feel like, this is probably a weird question, but when does it turn into too much? Like, when is it, you know, where you're kind of like, I mean, I'll never forget sitting with Al Andrews years and years ago. And we had met, and literally he was like, I think we're probably good for a while. And I was like, oh, okay. Like, and I was like, I think I agree with you. But like, there's a time to kind of go like, hey, now we engage with others. We engage with us. We engage, you know, we turn out there. So I guess those two questions, like one, what are the disciplines to make sure we're not overdoing it? You know, we're not too sort of self, we're staying inside ourselves for too long. And then two, when do you know, okay, this is, this is too much of this practice for now, or I've sort of examined enough to then turn outward again, you know?
Sure. Well, the first one is a real challenge, and it's as I say, it comes with the territory. Like I talked about, trauma trending to where people know about it now, and it's more culturally accepted. Therapy and counseling, definitely the same. It's become way more culturally accepted. More people are talking about it, which is such an advantage. And it's hard to go on social media and not hear somebody sharing every deep, dark secret they've ever had. Mm-hmm. And I think it's an authentic, genuine attempt most of the time. But I also know that we're humans, and humans that build their profession and their livelihood around influencing other people have recognized what people want. Mm. Pastors, speakers, orators, authors, therapists, and then just everyday people who have pop culture influence. They realized, if I share vulnerability now, that's trending. I can get more eyes, more shares, more feedback. Yeah. And that's where it gets a little bit dangerous. I think we've got to constantly assess ourselves and make sure our agenda and our motive is right. And I've done it. You know, early when I first started speaking, I would be up there probably oversharing and getting affirmation from it. That was an amazing talk. And then I look back years later and see or hear a talk, and I'm like, man, that seems like that was more about me than what I was trying to offer the audience. And I think it's just a learning experience. The beautiful thing about starting with understanding yourself and how you impact other people is that the more you stay on that, the more you become focused on the other people and less on yourself. Mm. But we can fall into that trap. I've done it. We all do it, to where you learn how to self-analyze, and you just study your belly button all day.
Yeah.
Right. And that does become dangerous, because it creates a bit of a victim mentality of you're constantly feeling like something has happened to me, something's wrong with me, and how do I get better? And I think people can get stuck in that. Mm. As far as when you know you're ready to take a break and or I graduate from a season of doing self-work, I don't think there's a black and white formula for that. I think there's an instinctual knowing that either you or the guide that you're with should bring to the table. Unfortunately, Al's a great example. When even you just said, you laughed and said, I want to tell you a story, and you mentioned Al's name. I laughed without even knowing the story, because we both share a friendship with Al, and I figured something awesome was coming. But he's a seasoned guy. He's a great counselor. He's just a great human. Mm. And he, in his mind, the last thing he would want would be dependence on him and his craft.
That's a great word.
So he looks at it like, this is a win if I get somebody to where I think they're ready to go do life. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And not everybody's there. There's a lot of, and that's okay. I think there's a lot of therapists on the way up that are like trying to preserve their practice and their business. And the longer they would see it more, the longer somebody's engaged with me, the better. Mm-hmm. And there's data to support that too. But I really admire the seasoned folks that can kind of push somebody out of the nest a little bit. Back when, pre-Onsite, I ran a residential program for young adults that treated addiction, trauma, and eating disorders. And I was new to the eating disorders field and really trying to learn as much as I could, as fast as I could. I just knew there were limited resources, and it was a very big issue that not a lot of people were talking about. Got the highest mortality rate of any mental illness, and people don't know that. And so we set up this 10-bed program, residential program, treating young adult women with eating disorders, and brought in some experts that knew how to treat it. And after analyzing the program for about a year, we were doing great treatment, but we'd over-curated the bubble to where they had no life experience. And then when we followed them on the back end, they were in this super safe environment, and then they go back into the world, and it was way too activating and overwhelming, and our results weren't great. And so we retooled it and thought, we need 2 months into treatment for them to go to the grocery store, for them to go back and engage in life, because that's as therapeutic as anything. So I've learned over time that just because we want to create psychological safety, we want safe people, but I've learned that safety doesn't really exist out there, because we're all human and we're all a mess. Safety exists in here, in ourselves. And as long as we can focus on that, we'll never refine it unless we go test it out.
Yeah.
Mm. Wow.
Do you find that in all your experience now that you have, do you feel like it has distilled down, like you're able to kind of take a bird's eye view of us human beings and our behaviors and our trauma and our brokenness? Does it feel like, I can see these simple patterns, or is it like, no, it's just as complex as it was on day one? You know what I mean?
That's a, what a great question. I've not had to think about it before. I don't think I've been asked it, but I would think as I step back and reflect on that, even momentarily, I do think I've evolved and seasoned to where I see people in the world differently based on my lived life experience and my profession. Mm-hmm. I'm not as quick to judge others. I'm human, so we judge all day long.
Right.
That's how we survive. But I'm not as quick to do that. I'm not as quick to engage in sometimes if, you know, I also run a business that employs 200-300 people. And so when you have that many people, you've got inherent drama, you've got challenges, you've got cultural issues. And you'd think that because we do what we do and we work in human behavior, we've got it all dialed in and get behind the curtain. We're just human like everybody else. And so when I experience that, and sometimes it's at me because of my leadership role, I used to be quick to go talk about it. Negative experiences with people, and now I'm not as much. I don't feel the need to, because sometimes mm-hmm. that's healthy. Sometimes it can turn into mm-hmm. gossip or drama. Yeah, that's the right. meeting after the meeting kind of thing.
Right.
I've noticed that maybe in seasoning and maturing and just experience that I have much more of an empathetic disposition on humanity, if you mm-hmm. will. It's a great question.
Yeah. Okay. So last question for you. We had Stephen James on forever ago, and he said something. We're pretty sure Stephen said this, or John said it. Somebody really wise. But this idea that we can only take our kids as far as we've gone ourselves, you know. Could you speak here at the end a little bit to us and to our listeners who most are parents? Why is it so important that parents get therapy, that parents sort of do the self work?
I really feel. And we've said that for years at OnSite too with our clients. Like, we're not willing to take you anywhere we haven't gone before. Mm-hmm. And as it relates to kids, I think it's been and is the most important thing we can do to pursue contentness in our lives. Mm-hmm. I'm not necessarily joy, happiness, just content mm-hmm. with who we are. And will we ever fully arrive there? Some claim they can. I don't know. I think there'll always be just a little bit of disdain in our lives. It's just the human experience. Mm-hmm. But I think if we are after pursuing the best version of ourselves, it makes the parenting job a lot easier because they're picking up on what they see and what they feel more than what they hear. They're going to remember what they hear, which is kind of nice because I never know the right thing to say.
Right.
And yet if I can show up the best version of me, I do think they pick up on it. So I fully agree. There's recently just a quick story. I guess it was a month and a half ago. I had to put down, arguably I would put her as the best friend I've ever had. Mm. She was my, just companion, little blue healer. Mm. And she lived a great life. For 13 years, she went with me step for step everywhere. Mm. And when she started losing her hearing and her vision, she had to come home. So when I went home, she still went with me step for step everywhere. But it was when I walked in the door, it was the first thing that greeted me. And then everywhere I walked, every room, she followed me. And she watched me. If you know that Australian breed, you know they do that really well. She always had an eye on me, and I didn't realize the impact that had on me until she was gone. And now that she's gone, I realize that's the most attuned I've ever felt.
Hmm.
And if I can think of the number one gift we can give people who've gone through stress, adversity, challenge, which, hello, every kid we raise goes through it because their brain's not developed. They don't have the ability to process emotions like adults do, so everything's going to blow them out. Hmm. That's difficult. The best thing we can give them is, I think, attunement. We can be with them, understand them, pay attention to them, connect with them. So much so that I think my dog taught me unconditional love, taught me attunement, and taught me and regrounded me in my faith. Because I think that's the way God looks at me, the way my dog took care of me. But now it's left a gap enough that when I walk in my house, we've got hardwood floors, and every room I go into, especially in the evenings, I hear her paw prints behind me. And I know she's not there, but sometimes I'm not ready to bear to turn around and face that she's still gone. But the part I wanted to share with you with, just the setup of that story, is that I love nature. I obsess with nature and aesthetics. I love things to look really pretty, and I y'all haven't been out to our place, I hope you'll come out and have lunch with me sometime. And our campus, I really want everything to be in place. And when you see it, every blade of grass is in place. I want people not to worry about anything and just to see beauty all around them. This is something I love. I love hospitality and aesthetics. Well, I want my house to be that way too. So I spent way too much money on my yard last year. Got irrigation and sod and new landscaping and blew the budget out, like doubled my budget. And as I was doing it, I knew I was doing it, and I thought, this is not a good idea. I don't need to spend this much money on a yard. And then when it was done, I stood and looked at it, and I thought, I'm so glad I did it. I love it. Until my mostly blind, deaf, now passed dog peed in the most prominent spot in my yard. So right out the front door, where every single person sees it and where I see it every day, is where she chose to pee, which we know urine kills grass, especially new grass. So I have a 5x foot dead spot in the very center of this place that I invested so much on. And it became such a thorn in my side that for the whole last year of her life, we had conflict every morning. I tried to train her to pee in the mulch. No chance. She just kept peeing in the same spot. To her, it made sense. It's like, it's the closest spot. Yeah, I can't see. I can't hear. What are you doing? But I kept, we'd go out, same routine, 6, 7 in the morning. She'd go out there and pee in the dead spot. I would be like, Dakota, dang it, you're killing the grass. Call the landscape. Can't do anything, you know. And now, 2 months, or a month and a half, 2 months after she's gone, every morning I go stand in that dead spot. And I find it to be the most beautiful thing on my property. And her last lesson for me, I think, is a lesson that I'm trying to pass on to my kids, which is the thing that I see that may not appear to be the prettiest and may rub me the wrong way may be the most beautiful thing, and I'll never know it until I don't have it anymore. So all the little pieces I'm seeing in my toddlers developing that drive me crazy, that make me feel like a terrible dad sometimes. I'm like, what am I messing up? I'm now seeing them like the dead spot in my yard. And as that spot starts to grow back with grass, I'm finding myself wanting to go get some Roundup. It's interesting that all I wanted was for it to go away, and now all I want is for it to remind me every day that there's beauty in the broken things.
Golly.
Wow.
Jeez, man.
We need to put out an extra episode that is just that story. And we need to put it out every day. Indefinitely.
Miles, thank you so much.
You're the man. Thank you for the work you're doing, too.
Yeah. Amen.
Thank you. Y'all make it easy. This was a fun conversation. I'd do it if we were recording or not. It was great to be with you guys.
We need to do it one more time.
Okay. Perfect.
Take two. Here we go.
Take two.